From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina has been happy to see state budget surpluses in recent years, but the new state treasurer is offering a warning about a long-term budget challenge. It's linked to government retirees. The University of North Carolina has a board of governors that oversees the statewide UNC system. The board recently heard some advice about what that oversight means. A group called NC MedAssist has worked for 20 years to provide free medication and health care advocacy for low-income and uninsured North Carolinians. You'll learn why. And we'll hear an update on efforts to scrap unnecessary state government rules. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
As hundreds of thousands of school-age kids are back in a North Carolina classroom or headed there very soon, Governor Roy Cooper has made a public plea for donations of school supplies. His request comes at the very same time that he and others are criticizing companies that operate public charter schools. Now, these two stories are related, says our next guest. Dr. Terry Stoops is the Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He's been following both of these stories. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
Before we get into these two stories, are North Carolina teachers really needing to spend their own money for school supplies, or are they doing this just because they want to enhance their classroom?
We have a little bit of both. You have teachers that are spending their own money because they need to, but a lot of the time you have teachers that want to decorate their classroom, and so they're going to the classroom supply store and they're buying border and they're buying and construction paper to make their classrooms look nice. There's no one compelling them to buy things to make their classrooms look nice. In other instances, there are teachers that are buying books and pencils and other items that will be used for classroom instruction. So you see both things happening.
The governor wants us all to go buy some supplies and donate them to our local school. Good idea, bad idea?
It's fine if parents are contributing to their local public school. I mean, there's certainly nothing wrong with them going and buying supplies for those who can't buy them for themselves. But what is often missing from this picture is that parents are buying supplies, and they're spending a lot of money on supplies. The average family spends $114 per child on school supplies, and that's only for one child. If you have multiple children, obviously you're spending a lot more than that, and that's because families, whenever you enter into a Walmart or any sort of store like that, will see stacks of papers with lists on them, and the lists contain multiple items that the teachers believe are needed for the classroom. And we're not just talking about pens and pencils. We're talking about tissues and sometimes food items. So it gets very expensive for a parent to provide these things. I think parents that can afford them, go ahead and fill out those checklists. But otherwise, there's nothing compelling those parents to buying school supplies for the school.
We know that within the state operating budget that there is a huge percentage of the operating budget that goes to K-12 education. Is some of that money for supplies?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a good amount for supplies, but it's not quite clear what supplies are. We have these general categories when we talk about the budget. And so what is considered supplies can be any number of different things. And so it's not quite clear what types of supplies schools and teachers are apparently running short of, or the ones supplies that schools are providing as opposed to not providing. So, you know, there's a lot of questions when you look at those budget numbers about what kind of supplies are actually being used and what kind of supplies need to be used.
Terry, you have been writing about some comments made by folks on the left side of the spectrum who've been very critical in these comments of some of the operators of public charter schools. Tell us what the argument is and why this really caught your attention more than usual.
Well, this comes down to the question of who can make a profit off of public schools. Who is who gets a pass and who is getting blamed for making a profit from public schools. So here's what happens. A charter management company will come in and help operate a charter school. And in exchange for those services, the charter school will pay that charter school management company or organization. And yes, they can make a small profit from it. That's the part that a lot of the left objects to, that there are charter management companies that help run charter schools that make a small profit, and it is a very small profit, off of running charter schools. But they will say nothing when a computer giant comes into a school and sells them thousands of computers at a profit, or when a school supply company comes into a district and provides them copy paper and makes a large profit. So it's really this double standard that the left has with who can and can't make a profit off of public schools. And of course, they don't like charter schools, so they're the ones that always get blamed for making a profit off of public schools, when in reality, these other kind of companies, the computer companies, the supply companies, are making billions.
I also wonder about the construction of a public school. I don't think we have a state agency that builds schools, do we?
No, not yet. And let's keep it that way.
Right.
But yes, everything that goes into a school, it's for-profit contractors using for-profit companies to buy materials. And you start thinking about the classroom, the desks, the blackboard, the books. And then you look outside and you see buses and fuel and all the items that go into making a school work. Most of those items are purchased from for-profit companies. The only person that really doesn't make a profit is the personnel, and that's the case in any sort of business or enterprise.
And yet the comments that are made at rallies and things like that from folks who are on the left side of the spectrum are very effective. There are many people who will shout back or hold a placard and say, that's right, we shouldn't be making money off of our kids. But is there a rational discussion to be had at this point on something like that?
I think that there is, but I don't see it happening, just because it's been such an effective talking point for the left to talk about these for-profit charter schools, and it gets that knot in your stomach when you think of someone making a profit off of kids. But long before we had charter schools, we had companies making profit off of kids, and this is really the important point that we need to come together and ask ourselves, why is there a double standard? Why can some make a profit off of public schools and others can't? And why are we pinpointing one and not the other?
Why are public charter schools unpopular in some quarters? They are part of the public school system.
Well, it's because they have flexibility to be able to do things that a traditional public school can't, and because it's not run by a school board and not really subject to much of the governance that comes down from the state and federal bureaucracy. And so they like to have as much control of the institution as possible. And what charter schools do is they decouple the school from the traditional ways of management for a school, which is the school board, the state board of education, and the bureaucracy. And they really dislike that. Plus, they dislike that they're so popular that people are flocking to them, because they don't really want to give parents choice. They don't really want kids to have a choice. They believe that they all should go to the public school of their design.
Are charter schools held accountable for how their students perform?
Absolutely. They take state tests, and so that means that a lot of charter schools actually end up using the state curriculum. So we know how charter schools are going to perform. And in fact, at the beginning of September, the state test scores are going to come out. So we'll have the state announcing how students did for the 2016-17 school year. We really have no indication at this point how students are going to do. We'll get graduation rates. But more importantly, we'll get that comparison between charter schools and district schools, because in the past, charter schools have outperformed district schools, and I expect the same to happen this year.
So, Terry, when those progressive activists who don't like the concept of charter schools say, well, it's because they get public money and then they aren't held accountable, any validity to that at all?
Absolutely not. They're held accountable not only by the state, but by the parents who choose them. And if parents choose not to send their children there, school will shut down for lack of funds. Or if they don't perform up to state standards, the State Board of Education will close it. That is real accountability. you don't have that kind of accountability in the traditional system. A school can fail year after year and still exist.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has made plenty of promises over the years, promises to state employees, teachers, law enforcement officers, firefighters, and many others regarding the state pension and health care plans. Well, those promises have a price. And joining us now to discuss that price is Dale Falwell, North Carolina's state treasurer. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
These are some promises that go back many, many decades, aren't they?
They are, and it's very important as we go through the next few minutes to differentiate with your listeners the difference between the pension promises and the health care promises. But there's one thing that overrides both of those topics, and that is these are invisible things. You know, things that people don't wake up and think about every day. But we are at a mathematical point in our state's history where the things that people do wake up thinking about, for example, roads and education and public safety and the zoos and the ports and the state parks, where this will be negatively impacting them over the next two decades.
And why is that?
The reason is that the state pension and the health plan are going to consume over $4 billion of the annual state budget every year for the next 15 years. That's before debt service. That's before any of the other core functions of state government. The reason is twofold. On the pension plan, it's the result of lower interest rates, which has resulted in the pension plan not earning its required rate of return on average for the last 15 years. It's also associated with the blessedness of increased life expectancies, which the pension plan never anticipated. On the health plan, it's the result of for decades and decades. We are and still continue to be on a pay-go basis where no money was ever put aside for people to be eligible for lifetime health care, and now that bill is coming due in a very rapid way.
In some respects, it sounds as if North Carolina is facing at the state level some of the same challenges the federal government is facing with things like Social Security and Medicare, all of these promises building up over time, mm-hmm. and now this bill's coming due.
Right, but the difference in this topic and the federal topic is that they don't have GASB standards that they have to live under. They don't have sort of what we call CAFRs, the audited financial statements. The accounting standards boards are requiring not only the state, but for your listeners, every county, every city, every school district, every governmental entity is now going to have to account for these long-term invisible liabilities going forward.
Plus, we can't print money and run deficits, can we?
Yes, I didn't want to bring up a blind glimpse of the obvious, but those are both very true.
So setting out that issue and how much these obligations are going to cost, what is it that you're trying to bring to the attention of policymakers about what we need to be doing to address these things?
Well, number one is we're trying to get to the bottom of it. And sometimes when you think you're at the bottom of something, you're really not. And obviously that's what I'm finding at the treasurer's office. The second thing is that we didn't do these things. I've been working on this for 10 years, so I feel like I have some ownership in discovering them. But now I have the responsibility of fixing them, and that's a tall order. What we're trying to do is we're trying to reduce complexity and build value. Now, let's start with the pension plan. We have 175 money managers managing 360 different funds, charging us over $600 million in fees every year. So we're trying to reduce the complexity by making sure that if we're paying somebody to actively manage our pension plan, that we're getting value over and above what we could get if we were in an index fund, which costs nearly nothing. On the Stay Health Plan, I don't think we have enough time in this interview to talk about how I'm reducing complexity and building value, but there's one tragedy in all this, and it's a strong word to use on a financial topic, but it's absolutely true. We have prison guards and beginning troopers and teachers and other beginning state employees who, if they choose family coverage this year, had to work 5 days out of every work month just to pay the family premium. Now, I say tragedy because the largest purchaser of health care in North Carolina is the state health plan. And the fact that we can't do it better and more efficiently on behalf of beginning teachers, troopers, and state employees, to me, is a tragedy. And mathematically, it's the reason we have the problems in our system, because it's made up of people my age and above who just take the individual coverage. So we have literally driven away all of our young, healthy people out of the state health plan, so it's made up of people like me. And my point of telling you that is that we're going to reverse that. And so we're going to do that by reducing complexity and building value.
We are chatting with Dale Falwell, who is North Carolina's state treasurer. You've been raising these issues since before your days as treasurer, when you were a member of the General Assembly, also during your work for the McCrory administration. Do you get the sense that enough people who are in positions to make decisions about these things realize this, that this is a problem, and want to do something about it? Or do we really need to sound the alarm bell to a greater extent?
I am very satisfied that these issues are top of brain and top of mind for all elected officials, not only in this state but other states. These new accounting standards are putting, biblically speaking, are putting light on this subject. So, number one. Number two, I've got to be very careful to always say that our pension plan is one of the best funded in the United States. But our pensioners can't pay Duke Power with how well funded something is. They have to pay them with cash. And so, I want to make sure it's 100% funded, because I'm the keeper of the public purse. Secondly, everybody's eyes glaze over when we start talking about a $42 billion unfunded health care liability or assumed rates of return. But these things manifest itself because the funding for these two programs then thereby become competition for funding for other things that people think about as a core function of their state government. All we're trying to do is to figure out what's right, get it right, and keep it right. And that's my job as the keeper of the public purse.
We aren't going to have time to get into the details of this, but I understand that one of the complicating factors in trying to make positive changes here is there are a number of court orders that have come out over the years that basically say, North Carolina government, you can do this, but you can't do this. And this kind of ties the hands, doesn't it?
It has. But, as the keeper of the public purse, I've applied for this job, and it's very important to me to underscore the word apply, because too often people run for public office and they put one thing on their job application, and then when they go to do the job, they do something different. I've applied for the job to be the keeper of the public purse, and with that comes the responsibility to be honest with the people of North Carolina, because inside this purse is money that belongs to Republicans, Independents, Democrats, people from the East, and people from the West. So the court cases obviously are having a big impact on us, but it does not deter me from figuring out what's right, getting it right, and keeping it right. And that's what I intend to do for as long as I'm the treasurer of North Carolina.
In the very brief time we have remaining, if North Carolina does nothing about these issues, if we just sat back and said, oh, it'll work itself out, we don't need to take any special action, what would be the negative consequences?
The negative consequences is that our AAA bond rating would be more in jeopardy. We're now one of 12 states that have a AAA bond rating. Wyoming just lost its AAA with one of the rating agencies. And regardless of what political party you're a member of, the fact is that when we are able to borrow money at lower interest rates, that's more classrooms, that's more asphalt, that's more everything.
Well, we know one person who's going to be watching this issue very closely during his term as state treasurer is Dale Falwell. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me and enlightening the people of North Carolina.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue. More visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read. A new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. No, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal. We hold government accountable to you.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. A board of governors oversees the University of North Carolina system. But what does oversight mean? Belle Whelan heads up the regional accreditation group that deals with Southeastern universities. She offered the UNC board a recent presentation.
There are three things that we ask boards to do. We ask you to make policy, not to administer policy, but to make policy, to put a policy in place for what you want to see done. We ask that you hire, evaluate, and if necessary, fire the CEO. And we ask you to have fiduciary responsibility for the institutions. That is all. When boards start micromanaging, you're stepping out of your lane and it gets my attention and then I have to come back in a different capacity. Okay, I have been a board member. It is tough as nails to sit back and let somebody else decide how to do something when you know that you can do it differently and better. I understand that. But I'm hopeful that you have full-time jobs or something else to keep you busy, that you don't feel the need to do that.
What do the rules say about academic freedom?
Now, I tell faculty all the time, this does not mean that you can say anything you want to say. That is not what academic freedom is. But it does mean that you may disagree with something that a faculty member is teaching in their course, but because they are the faculty and you hired them as a subject area expert, again, unless you have a policy that precludes it, then you're going to have to live with it.
Board member Marty Kotis offered a word of caution about academic freedom.
There's this fine line, I think, between academic freedom and religious persecution out there that we need to be mindful of. And there's an opportunity for professors to overstep and take away rights from others. So I think there's this line out there, again, that sometimes happens in free speech overall, where you may have rights, I may have rights, but there's this balance out there, and it's not one side or the other.
Kotis also asked Whelan how she's addressed faculty complaints about the UNC board.
I did get a letter from the faculty senates collectively from your institutions, and I asked them to please let me come make this presentation to you first, because I was not convinced that you all were familiar enough with who we are to understand what requirements we have that directly impact the board. There were some things over which I had no control because I don't accredit legislators or legislatures. And, you know, there are things that the governor and the legislature did that, didn't have any choice over, kind of thing. So I've not done anything with those complaints yet other than come here today.
That's Belle Whelan of the accreditation group that oversees UNC system schools. She recently offered a list of do's and don'ts to the system's Board of Governors. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Since 1997, a group called NC Medicist has worked to provide free prescription medications, healthcare advocacy, and related educational services to low-income and uninsured North Carolinians. Joining us to discuss NC Medicist is its board chair, Sid Bernstein. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. I'm very happy to be here and appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
So tell us, I gave a very brief description, but what is the main intention and goal of NC Medicist?
There are two really main goals. One is to work with uninsured North Carolinians, of which there are about 500,000. About 84% of our patients are working poor, which means that they're at 100% or below the federal poverty level. And along with providing the free medication, we're interested in creating cost avoidance for the state of North Carolina. So every dollar that we provide in medication, it contributes probably another dollar in cost avoidance. So by cost avoidance, we're referring to decrease in emergency room visits, decreases in hospitalization, keeping people off the welfare rolls, unemployment, et cetera, et cetera. So we work in a very humanitarian mission, both for the patients who receive the free medications and for the taxpayers.
You mentioned the cost avoidance for state government, and I would imagine that is one of the first things that caught people's interest as they're listening to us, because they think, okay, uninsured people, low-income people, this is probably a program that has something to do with government, but what you're talking about is something that's outside of the government programs, the ones that are costing taxpayers, isn't it?
That's correct. It's a completely private, not-for-profit. We do receive grants from the state of North Carolina and Mecklenburg County, but most of our funding comes from private foundations and individuals. So it is a non-governmental institution. We partner, I should say collaborate, really, with the pharmaceutical industry, which is the provider, the principal provider of the free medications. In the current fiscal year, which will end in the end of this week, we will have provided about $42 million in free medications to 15,000 North Carolinians.
How does it work? I mean, we know how government programs work. Someone goes to their local
Sure.
health department or social services. They sign up for a program, and if they're eligible, they get assistance. How would someone get involved with NC MedAssist?
Very often, they're coming in through the 101 free clinics that are located throughout the state of North Carolina that provide medical care, medical attention to the uninsured. We collaborate with them, and they actually act as a port of entry and make us aware of their patients. Then the patients do go through a qualification and enrollment process. Those standards are really established by the pharmaceutical industry, which provides the bulk of our medication, and they must be basically uninsured, so we have to verify that they're uninsured, that they don't qualify for Medicare or Medicaid. That their income is 200% or below the federal poverty level, and that's validated. The one thing that we don't do, or not able to do, and I shouldn't say we don't do, we'd like to do it, is we really can't validate the authenticity of Social Security numbers. So there are probably a number of illegal aliens that slip through the cracks, but I would say the vast majority, probably greater than 95% of our patients are citizens and qualify for the services that we provide.
And most of them, as you were saying, access this. They start off at going to a free clinic.
Yes.
And you find out about them. They find out about you through
exactly.
that process. We're speaking with Sid Bernstein, who is board chair for NC MedAssist. Some people might be listening to us and saying, why have this program? Isn't the government taking care of this? Aren't our tax dollars already going to this? Why is it important to have something like this that is a private, not-for-profit alternative?
It really speaks to the issue of the inefficiency of government and meeting the needs of its society and the culture and individuals. We do this because in North Carolina, there are 500,000 uninsured North Carolinians who do not qualify for Medicaid, or they do not qualify for Medicare. They certainly are poor, cannot afford private insurance, so they fall outside of the safety net. We're basically a safety net to the safety net.
And in so doing, because this is not going through government, are there some efficiencies that we see with NC MedAssist that we would not normally see with a government-run
Sure.
program?
Absolutely. So we operate with a budget of about $2.7 million. This year it'll probably be closer to three. With that $3 million and employing a staff of 25 people, we're able to distribute $41, $42 million in free prescription medications, another $2 million in over-the-counter medications. And I should mention there as well that with over-the-counter meds like Tylenol, Robitussin, diuretics, and things like that, or antidiuretics, actually. We provide $6 in cost avoidance because very often those simple, easy-to-treat medications keep people out of the ER, which is probably the most expensive place to receive medical care. So the efficiency really is that on a $2.7 million budget, $42 million in free prescription meds, $2 million in over-the-counter meds, and $56 million in cost avoidance.
You mentioned just and alluded to it earlier, but do we see some positive health outcomes from having this type of arrangement as compared to
Yeah.
the standard government way of doing this?
Interestingly, many patients that are Medicaid recipients have health outcomes that are really not better than someone who's uninsured. Our patients self-report, and this is hard to validate, that their compliance to their medication is 97%, and that they're now able to buy food and have their medicine. Very often it's a choice of one or the other. So the overall outcomes simply are that people are able to maintain their jobs, they're able to provide for their families, albeit to a limited degree, and essentially stay off the welfare rolls.
In the limited time that we have left, you mentioned that this is does have a couple of grants from government agencies, but it's primarily
a philanthropic
venture.
Yes.
Why do people who support the organization see this as a valuable use of their resources?
I think exactly that. There are probably two main reasons. There's certainly the humanitarian component. That's very, very important to many people. And very often the cost benefit, the fact that we are saving the state of North Carolina money and taking care of a needy population. So those are the two primary motivators.
Well, it's certainly a very interesting program, NC MedAssist. It's been around since 1997, and as we just learned, helping save the state taxpayers by serving a function for low-income and uninsured North Carolinians who otherwise aren't served. The chairman of the board of NC MedAssist is Sid Bernstein. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Too much bureaucratic red tape? Too many onerous rules. It's not an empty complaint from North Carolina business owners and any North Carolinian who's actually tried to navigate state government. In fact, in North Carolina, there are an estimated 22,500 state rules. It's a number so high that it got the attention of state legislators in 2013. That's when they began an effort to actually clean up this maze of rules. John Sanders is the Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He follows this issue very closely, and he's here to give us an update. John, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
Who would be impacted by one of these 22,500 rules?
Businesses, individuals, nonprofits, pretty much everyone across North Carolina, depending upon what field they're in.
So if someone...
independent contractors, people who are setting themselves up as self-employment, and going into business for themselves even.
And people might be surprised if they're just trying to transact business in the state or apply for a license or do something like that, that there typically would be some sort of paperwork or rule or regulation that they have to comply with. They may not even know it.
Probably not in some cases.
Now, back in 2013, as I mentioned, state legislators really decided that they wanted to take a look at all of this because 22,500 is a pretty high number. What were they concerned about, John, when they decided to look at this?
It was part of an ongoing effort that's still ongoing, cutting out regulations and red tape. It was one of the more important reforms, sunset provisions with periodic review. Basically, what that is every time a new regulation is promulgated by an agency, by an executive state agency, it has to come up for a review within 10 years or it automatically sunsets. And the way that the reviews work is the agency can determine well, we really don't need this rule anymore, so it's called unnecessary and it's immediately repealed. Or they would say it's necessary and then see if they take any public comment on it. There would be a public comment period. So if they receive comments that are on point, you know, instead of someone just kind of waving a cane and saying, I don't like that thing, right. Then it would be necessary if they got a comment on it, would be necessary with substantive comment, and they would have to those rules would have to go back through the rule-making process as if it were a new rule. And if no one said anything about it and the agency called it necessary, it would immediately re-up as necessary without substantive public interest.
It sounds as if the goal here, John, would be to make sure that if there's a legitimate need for some sort of a rule or regulation, that it either is instituted as a new rule or it continues to exist. But if something for any reason is unnecessary or the whole mission or goal was outdated, that let's just get rid of it.
Yes. And that happens. Talking about how businesses and people don't know some of the things that affect them, these rules get lost. Some of them just kind of fall through the cracks in memory over time, and some may have nothing to do with modern ways of doing things. Now, it's good to pull these things out of the tool shed, sort of, so to speak, and dust them off and see if they're still needed.
We've got an example that I asked you to bring to this interview because I wanted to give our listeners a chance just to have some sort of idea about what we're talking about here. There is a rule that has been removed, and it had to do with drinking water. Give us kind of the Reader's Digest version of that.
Now, basically, there's a package of rules that the Department of Environmental Quality has regarding a federal safe drinking water plan, and the state, I'm reading through it all, it's you know, like a lot of rules, it's quite involved. But the gist of it is the federal government pretty much already does it, and the state rules are obsolete, and there's no need to hold on to them any longer. So they have repealed a whole package of rules that are duplicative and obsolete.
Now, this particular package of rules, then, is among those that you've been monitoring that have been cleared from the books. Where are we on that? We start out with 22,500 rules. How many have been removed?
I just looked at the numbers for August 2017, and we're about halfway through the process. We've done a little over 11,300 and some rules. And where we are in the process is that about one-eighth of them have been repealed. We've already repealed one-eighth of all the rules that have been looked at. Another about one-fourth, 25%, have been added to be re-examined through the rulemaking process again. So necessary with substantive public interest. And then 62% have been automatically re-upped.
John, I think it makes common sense to people that if something is no longer needed, that you would wipe it off the books. But there are even more involved reasons relating to the economy that we would want to take a look at all of these rules and regulations every now and then. Explain that relationship between red tape and rules and prosperity and economic growth.
Well, the bulk of economic literature looking into regulations find that they have a depressive effect on the economy. They're basically a deadweight loss because they require time be spent in satisfying strictures, paperwork, things like that, instead of going to productive endeavors. And so there's a trade-off as to whether these are important and whether they are simply annoying, I guess would be one way of putting it. So it's always good to take another look at these sorts of things. And in fact, some research by Mercatus scholars has found that the sunset provisions with periodic review have a very substantive effect on reducing regulation and also on helping a state's economy, unlike a lot of other review processes. This one actually works.
And that's an important point, because one of the things that you have written very recently is that when the state legislature started looking at this whole question in 2013, they didn't make their decision just willy-nilly as, okay, let's just start looking at all these rules. They actually went to some research to find out what's the most effective way to do this. And this periodic review is an effective way. And that seems to be proving out here in North Carolina.
Yeah, and that's what I'm encouraged with. And now with that in place, we can start doing what I call sunrise provisions. And so address the problem on the other side of it, on the rulemaking side of it, so that we are putting into place several good things in that way.
And what types of recommendations are you making in that area?
Well, and one would be sort of a Rains Act for North Carolina, where if it's an extremely burdensome rule that the General Assembly has some say over it with, instead of just granting the executive agency carte blanche to put it through, there could be have alternatives or a cost-benefit analysis, a strong cost-benefit analysis put through. Something that the Trump administration is doing that has also been done in British Columbia and the UK, in having sort of a regulatory budget where an agency, if they want to provide a new rule, they have to get rid of an old rule or two.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Come back again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.